On my way here, I was telling myself, now remember, nobody wants a 15-second sermon. We did bad, let's try and do better. And nobody wants to hear everything I have to say about this because we don't have that long. And that was a good reminder to me, not because I speak too long or I speak too short or anything else. What it reminded me of, more than anything, was the complexity of what we're talking about when we talk about truth and reconciliation. And we're talking about truth and reconciliation, in our case, in the context of the texts that we have had read for us. And so we read, so as Kelly read for us, we have things like Zechariah 8:16-17, where it says, "These are the things you are to do. Speak the truth to each other and render true and sound judgment in your courts. Don't plot evil against your neighbor. Don't love to swear falsely." That's not very hard, is it? I mean, really, we look at those things and go, oh, well, if that's what you require, that I can do that. I mean, sometimes it's hard. You know, speaking the truth to each other, there are times when you've done something really dumb and it comes to light, and it's often very tempting to gloss over it or maybe say it happened to somebody else or something else. But we can still rise above that. And honestly, one of the things that I found is that for the most part, if people are going to mislead you, it's about things that are dumb, hardly ever about things that are evil, at least in our context. In the context of a community of believers, we understand we are fallen people, and that we can do bad things. And when we do bad things, we tend to bring them up to other people so we can become better. When we do foolish things, we tend to hide them because they make us, well, feel foolish. And on the whole, I think that part of human nature isn't the worst part of us. I think it's just a thing to be aware of. But I look at that, and I'm aware of the history that went into the founding of this hemisphere. And I'm aware of some of the things that went into it, and I'm aware that most of the excesses that we see in history had their impetus in religious people saying, this is what you can do and this is what you can't. There are no existing documents, and nor do I think there ever were, coming out of Spain or out of Portugal or out of England or out of anywhere else that said, you should go and be cruel to people. That was never part of it. What it was a grotesque misunderstanding of the reality of the fullness of the humanity of the initial or original inhabitants of this hemisphere. And we read things that are foolish and insulting, like they're children. They don't know any better. They need to be taught. It's just as well to enslave them, because slavery, of course, was okay, because that will teach them to become more like us. Now, how that works, I don't know. But at some level, if I'm not going to go crazy and hit things, I have to believe that these people were not doing this maliciously to destroy a culture. What they thought they were doing was okay. The problem was they were wrong. And we can all be wrong about things. I myself am frequently wrong about things. Clayton and I are doing math now. I am frequently wrong about my memory of how do you get the circumference of a circle. But I look it up and I find, like, we can be wrong about all kinds of things, most of which aren't terribly important. But how do you be so incredibly wrong about an entire hemisphere, a continent, about peoples? Well, I don't know. I don't have an easy answer to that, because those people read the same things that we do and that we read today. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For anyone who loves people has fulfilled the law. The commandments, do not commit adultery, don't murder, don't steal, don't covet, and whatever other commandments there may be are summed up in this one rule. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to its neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. I simply cannot reconcile that with the doctrine of discovery and terra incognito that said by the religious leaders of the time that North and South America were essentially empty of people that mattered. And I don't understand how anyone could look at other human beings and say they don't deserve the things that I deserve if I'm familiar with the Bible. Yes, there are psychopaths out there, and there are not that many of them, really. Somehow, people managed to take what they had read and what they had preached on, because these words came not from ignorant soldiers wanting to get away with things. These words, the doctrine of discovery and the rest, those documents that helped shape how these continents were treated by Europeans, which have been repudiated explicitly by the Presbyterian Church in Canada, were written by religious scholars who knew the Bible well. And somehow, they got it so badly wrong. I've encountered various writers who speak and write about the unspeakable, about the Holocaust, about the treatment of the indigenous peoples of North America, about the treatment of the indigenous people of the Pacific Islands, all of these things. And often they say, as part of their introduction, is that one of the things that is most tempting when you start thinking carefully about this is to curl up in the fetal position and hope the whole world goes away. And sometimes that's what I feel like. And maybe you do too. And if you do, that's okay. Because what's happening is you are beginning to grasp in a way that maybe is as far as we can go as people who are not from any of those cultures, to understand what it meant to be so dehumanized. And from our perspective, to be dehumanized under the name of Jesus, whose Sermon on the Mount Kelly read for us. And I look at the Beatitudes and I just think, how are these things possible? How is anyone who survived a residential school going to look at this as anything other than insulting? And one of God's greatest gifts to me has been the opportunity to attend General Assembly twice. And both times we dealt with difficult issues that encouraged and maybe even sort of forced people to look deeply within themselves and then talk about what they saw. And one of the best things that happened to me was sitting at a table talking about what it means to be a residential school survivor with a residential school survivor who is in that particular age group where his parents had also gone to residential school. And when they'd somehow got together and had him, then he was taken to residential school. He was one of the happiest people I'd met at General Assembly. How? How was that possible? How could he have gone through what he went through and his parents and his grandparents and all the rest of it? And I realized that when Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." This isn't just some kind of a platitude that you turn into a cross-stitch sampler and stick on the wall. Those who mourn will be comforted. Those who are meek will inherit the earth. Those who are merciful will be shown mercy. He talked about some of the things that he did, working with other survivors. and working with white people. Working with white people who felt authentically bad and helping them realize that they could feel bad till the cows come home. And that's only a beginning. You have to do something. You can't just be going around feeling bad. And you can't just be not racist. We need to be anti-racist. We need to oppose this kind of thing. We need to oppose the kind of talk we hear often that, oh, those people. As soon as you hear the words, those people, something bad is going to happen. It's right down there with, I hate to be brutally honest. No, you don't. Nobody hates to be brutally honest. The people who are brutally honest enjoy it. People who say anything about those people, about some identifiable group, the chances of them telling you something wonderful about it are really slim. We need to pop our ears up when people say things like, well, those people, they don't work hard enough. Say, what are you talking about? What's your evidence? How many of these people have you met? Which of them has been a fellow worker who slagged off work on a regular basis? It's not enough for us anymore to be sad. Yes, we have to be sad. We will be sad. I will be sad for the rest of my life. About this and about a bunch of other things. About losses that I had nothing to do with that affect me deeply because of the kind of person I am. I'm not saying this is the case for all of you. But when we think carefully about this, when we think about truth and reconciliation, when we think about truth, what actually happened, I don't see how it can't make us sad. Maybe even angry. And those things are okay. But that's the beginning. And I'm here to tell us here and you online, we are not going to fix racism. We are a mighty group. When John Borthwick was here, when he was coming here, he said he was looking forward to coming to preach to the small but mighty congregation of St. Mark's. And I thought about that, and I thought, that's kind of a joke, but it's also true. And we're a mighty, small but mighty, because we serve God. Not because we ourselves are big and burly people, because, well, none of us really are. But because we serve God. We love God and we want to make a difference. And so one of the things that we do if we're willing to serve truth is we look at what is truth. And the truth is that residential schools were appalling. That for centuries, people of color have been misused and abused in our culture, in our country. Canada had slavery until the 1800s. We can look down our noses at our neighbors to the south as much as we like, but we should probably take a good long look at ourselves first. We have racism in the same way that every other place has racism. And just like every other place, we can do something about it. We're not going to go and fix, well, we're not even going to fix Moose Jaw. But we're going to fix the people around us as we fix ourselves. As we deal with those, with the unconscious racism that we just absorbed because we lived where we lived and we're the color that we are. It's hard to admit, and I'm not going to tell you that you are one of these people, but I'll tell you I am. That I absorbed things that I'm still discovering now. I'm 62 years old. I grew up in a home that had a strong commitment to equality, a strong commitment to the value of our Indigenous fellow citizens, which is how my dad thought of the First Nations people. He grew up in a homestead in northern BC, where everybody closed their door to the Indigenous people except his dad. My dad said he never knew who was going to be lying on the floor when he woke up in the morning. Because in the winter, if it was cold, his dad, the door was always open to anyone. First Nations, Caucasian, he didn't care. It's cold. You deserve a place to not be cold. I grew up in that home. And I still have these things that pop up to my shame even now. Jokes that I heard when I was in school, attitudes that friends and coworkers had that subtly influenced how I react to particular people. And I work against them every time they come up. And maybe you have those things too, and maybe they discourage you, as they discouraged me, and still do. But that man at General Assembly, who had all those connections with residential school, when I talked about how painful it was to me and all of that, he said, just, it's okay. I said, what? He said, you weren't there. You didn't do this. You don't have to feel that bad, but you do have to try and make it better. And then he laughed, because he was just the happiest person I met at General Assembly. He said, it's okay. I'm okay. Many of us are okay. He said, I learned how to read at residential school. I might not have learned how to read otherwise. He said, that doesn't mean it was a good experience. But he looked at maybe the only good thing he got out of it, but he saw it. And when I had that interaction, I stopped being only discouraged when these things pop up, and instead looked at them and said, okay, I didn't choose to go to that school. I had to go to that school. It was the only elementary school in town. People told jokes about ethnic groups. And I heard them and I laughed because I didn't know any better. And even when I did know better, I laughed. And that changed me a little bit on the inside, and not in a good way. And I've been working ever since trying to get back to what I might have been otherwise. That's part of reconciliation. Reconciliation does not mean, as somebody once said, running out and hugging the first person of an identifiable minority you find. That's called assault. Don't do that, please. No. Truth and reconciliation go together because first we admit the truth of what happened, even though we did not do it, but we are responsible for it in the same way that we are responsible occasionally for the debts of our parents if things go wrong. We have a responsibility, not the responsibility, for these things. That's the truth. And the reconciliation part is that we don't just take this truth and park it with all those other truths that we believe, but we don't act on. Reconciliation means changing ourselves so we can be better and we can help each other change. Reconciliation means that we are aware or become more aware of our unconscious racism and bigotry, which, according to the scientists and researchers who study this, we all have. And when we are aware of it, not throwing our hands up and saying, well, there's no hope, because there is hope. There's loads of hope, because blessed are those who mourn. They will be comforted. The meek will inherit the earth. The merciful will be shown mercy. The peacemakers, the reconcilers, will be called the children of God. And all of this comes up, and all of this is summed up in something that I say over and over again, that if Jesus says that everything in the Bible is summed up with love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind, and your neighbor is yourself, and Jesus has shown us that our neighbor is any human being that we come in contact with, acting on those two things will make us agents of reconciliation. Because we know the truth within us, we know the task before us. It's to be agents of reconciliation. It seems like a big, hard thing. And if we had to fix it all, it would be. But no, what we do when we go from this place, aware of this truth as agents of reconciliation, is we walk out of here, loving the Lord our God with all our heart and soul and mind, and loving whoever we come across as ourselves. And that's it. Amen.